experimenting is a big part of science. You know, you can collect data, and if you never think about, you know, we use the term expectations a lot. You know, if you haven't been coaching very long, haven't coached a lot of athletes, like, you don't even know what to expect. So if you're just tracking like what's happening in the data, you know, you can go in a lot of different places, because if you've been coaching long enough, your expectations are going to be a bit more calibrated. You know, there are certain things that you might do in training that in the short term are going to have some sort of negative effect on your athlete, but long term can have a positive effect. And if you didn't know that and didn't have those expectations and only looked at data and you saw things tracking down, you'd say, oh, that's bad, don't do that, try something else. That's not necessarily a scientific approach, and you know, there's not experimentation there.
Hi, Dylan. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. So I'll kind of start where things get kind of like relevant to this discussion and work more towards where I'm at now. So I was a weightlifter, got into Olympic weightlifting when I was about 20, 21 years old. From there, I was in college and wanted to find a place where I can kind of study and focus on weightlifting full time. The time that led me to East Tennessee State University, where I did my undergraduate degree in exercise science while competing as a weightlifter as a part of their like varsity collegiate weightlifting team. While there is where I kind of got introduced to a bit to the world of like sports science, and where I realized that there was graduate degrees in this sort of stuff. Before that, I didn't even really know that that was a thing. And it immediately interested me. I was like, oh, I can get a master's and a PhD in sport. Like, that's cool. So what I did was I just pretty much stayed at ETSU for as long as they would let me. I did my master's degree there while I continued to be a competitive weightlifter. My master's degree is in applied sports science. And then I transitioned to do my PhD in sport physiology there and got a bit more into like the research world. Initially was kind of considering being a strength and conditioning coach, and then got interested in like more of the sports science research realm during my master's, which is the reason I decided to kind of go on to the PhD. So I went on to the PhD, got a bit more involved and starting to like produce some research. I transitioned out of being a competitive weightlifter myself and focused more on the coaching end. So I was a coach for our weightlifting team at ETSU, and then kind of also led our sports science and like monitoring specifically for the weightlifting team while I was there. When I was kind of wrapping up my dissertation, I took an internship in Las Vegas with the UFC Performance Institute as a sports science intern, and started to kind of get introduced to a bit more of the world of being an applied sports scientist and professional organizations. Enjoyed that a lot, learned a lot there while I was there for about 6 months. That immediately led me into a role with the Cincinnati Reds as an applied sports science coordinator. So moved into the baseball realm, working in sports science. Did that for a year, got a role, a bit of a promotion role with the San Francisco Giants as their senior applied sports scientist. Did that for the last 2 years for the Giants. And then just very recently took a new role that brought me back across the country again. I moved up from Arizona back to Florida and just started a new role a few weeks ago working with military and tactical populations.
That sounds like many people's dream, I would say.
It's been fun. Every experience has been, I've learned a lot. Every experience has kind of been like, oh, this is the dream job. And then another one comes that is even cooler. So yeah, I've been lucky so far.
Today, we'll be talking about your review paper on athlete monitoring, specifically in strength sports. So on this podcast, we explored athlete monitoring from the perspective of strength and conditioning coach, more so than specifically for weightlifters or powerlifters. So I'm super excited to have you. And let's start with why athlete monitoring in strength sports?
Sure. So I think, you know, monitoring just very generally, whether we're talking about like for sport or not, I think really just comes down to making sure what you either think or expect or want to happen is happening. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. Like, you can do that with or without technology. But at the end of the day, having some sort of like concrete historical record of what's happening over time, along with the things that you're trying to do, so along with your training program, allows you, I think, to kind of at a more faster pace, kind of like iterate and improve on whatever you're doing, rather than just kind of like subjectively over time thinking like, oh, maybe doing this would be better. And then more specific to strength sport, what I think about is nice about strength sports is at the end of the day, like the outcome of the sport is like a numeric value, which actually makes tracking it and assessing like what works, I would say, a lot simpler than some of the other places I've worked, like, you know, baseball or especially like tactical populations, where like the end outcome of all everything we're doing is not going to be tied to a nice like number, you know, weightlifting total of 250 kilograms. Whereas in the strength sport realm, it is, you actually have this like numerical value that you can tie into things. So I think for that reason, there's almost like no reason not to be able to be trying to do some sort of like systematic monitoring to be able to like assess the effect that you're having on, you know, the strength athlete that you're working with.
All right. So what are the options? What are the options for athlete monitoring in strength sports?
Yeah. So we kind of like within the paper broadly categorized it into kind of like four different categories specifically for monitoring. So one, you can kind of separate them into like subjective versus objective monitoring. So subjective monitoring can, again, we can start with how they slept, you know, various different things like that. And they reply, you know, I slept really well. I'm feeling pretty sluggish. I'm very sore. Those are subjective criteria that they're providing you that you can use to manipulate your program, you know, in the acute sense that day or like over time to kind of produce the outcomes that you want. And then with that subjective stuff, you can also start to introduce very basic technology and data gathering. So instead of just asking them, you can turn it into a very basic survey or form. It's pretty free to do. You can use things like Google Forms or Microsoft Forms to do it. And you can ask those very same questions. You know, how is your sleep? Rate on a quality 1 to 10. You know, how are you feeling? What is your muscle soreness? And it can be really basic, or there's, you know, very specific validated questionnaires that we talk a little bit about in the review paper that have done this in different sort of athletic populations and validated them. And, you know, there's some like research supporting them. So those can be found online and you can just kind of recreate them, or, you know, you can also try and, you know, do it on your own. On the objective side of things, this can be, you know, a whole host of things. It can be things like bar speed. So you can use technology such as velocity-based tracking. It could be measures like training loads. So the weight on the bar, you know, is it going up or down? Those are all objective things. You know, you can't make up how much weight is on the bar. It just is what it is. So those are like really simple examples. The other kind of criteria that we broke it into is internal and external. And this is more specifically referring to load monitoring that these are usually separated into. So the easiest way to think of it is external are the things that are being applied to the athlete or are creating the stress or strain on them. And then internal is their actual physiological or even psychological reactions to those external loads. So in a strength sports context, again, for the most part, the external loads are pretty simple. You know, they're the load on the bar. In other sports, there's a lot more things to consider. You have environmental loads and things like that. Strength sports, it's relatively simple. It's, you know, it's the sets, it's the reps, it's the weight that they're doing. And then the internal loads are going to be like their reactions to it. The most common example of that is going to be your RPE, so your rating of perceived exertion. So just real simplistic example of internal external load monitoring. Athlete does 3 sets of 5 squats with 150 kilos one day. They would rate it and their rating might be a 7 out of 10. So you have your external 3 sets of 5, 150 kilos. Your internal rating was, you know, a 6 or 7 out of 10. 3 to 4 months later, they do that same external load, 3 sets of 5 at 150 kilos. Their internal rating can be very different. You know, it could be higher, which would tell you something, or it could be lower, which would, you know, show some positive adaptation that we're looking for. And I think these are valuable things to monitor within a strength sports program, because anybody that's been a strength athlete for a long time or worked with strength athletes for a long time knows that progress like isn't linear, and you're not always going to be able to put 10 kilos on your total like every single year, like when you first started. So if the only thing you're ever able to measure progress on is you're snatching a clean and jerk or you're bench pressing your deadlift, like eventually those are going to, you know, PRs are going to come few and far between, and it's going to be hard to monitor how effective your program is until you show up on meet day fully peaked after a full long macro cycle and see how everything went. But if it doesn't go well, then you got to wait for a whole another training cycle to find out, you know, again, what works. Whereas if you have this kind of like these ratings of internal external load on a regular basis, you can start to get an idea of, you know, are they moving a greater load at the same rating? You know, that would obviously be a positive adaptation. Are they moving the same load, a similar or lower rating? That those are all also signs of a causative adaptation. Now, they're not always going to be perfectly correlated to moving a greater absolute load, which at the end of the day, the goal of the training program, but it will offer some beneficial motivation, one, to the athlete to be able to have something to track progress other than just PRs, because, you know, those are going to be harder and harder to come by. And then it also provides like the coach more regular feedback on the physical and psychological state of the athlete, like within specific sessions or weekly training, like rather than, like I said earlier, just waiting for like end of a macro cycle to see if everything they did work. Because we know you could potentially do everything perfectly, and then the last week of training, they could get sick or something can happen, and then that can screw up their, you know, competition total. If that's the only thing you're using to assess how your training is going or how your training program is affecting the athlete, well, you know, you're getting very, very few data points. You're peaking 2 to 3 times a year. You've got 2 to 3 data points in 365 days, which is only going to be so helpful to you.
I think it's also important to mention that at least in Olympic weightlifting, at some level, you cannot peak for every competition. Or differently, there are important competitions you want to peak for, and you will sacrifice more peaking opportunities for this one. What I mean is, you may want to invest the time to build strength or to work on some work around the injury or some kind of other deficit you may have or the athlete may have, and you will on purpose not peak for a longer time, let's say, I don't know, 20 weeks or something, preparing for international level competition, then you need something else to track your progress and to see whether the adaptations you're programming are actually occurring and whether you are fixing the things you want to fix or building where you want to build, like building a larger base so you can have a higher peak, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. Yeah. And you know, those like still occasionally competing, but not going for a peak, I think is still valuable just learning competing and weightlifting. But it can be tough, like on the athlete side of things, both from personal experience and coaching. Like it's hard to get as motivated for a competition that you know, like you're not fully physically ready for. So yeah, like, and then in the week leading up to it, if you know you're not necessarily going to have that opportunity to set that new record, set that new PR, and then you have no other way to track like if you're progressing or getting better, you know, it can get pretty demotivating. You know, weightlifting and powerlifting can be very monotonous, difficult sport. So like any little addition that you can make to be able to show progress, I think personally is really helpful in the strength sports realm.
All right. So we went through internal load, external load. We went a little bit through the subjective and objective measures. Do you think we're ready to move into methods? So going through specific options we have to actually use in strength sports for monitoring?
Yeah. So some examples and some like a good way we separated in the paper of the main like monitoring categories you would kind of want to look at and focus on in strength sports are, one, going to be kinetics. So this is all about the forces applied, and then kinematics, which are going to be about like the positions and movement and velocity and things like that. And then the third really important is going to be body composition. So things like the amount of muscle mass you have, body fat percent, and things like that. So we'll start kind of with like the kinetic realm, highly relevant to all sports because every movement requires a force to be produced, right? It's just physics. Produce is necessary. And strength sports is especially relevant because we're trying to move very large absolute loads, which require, all else equal, very high forces to be created. If everything else is the same, you know, anthropometrics, limb lengths, technique, everything equal, the athlete that produces higher force is going to lift a greater load. So one, being able to assess force and also being able to separate it from the skill component of strength sports is really important, because a lot of our training program is focused on developing force characteristics, right? Trying to develop muscle hypertrophy, trying to develop muscle strength, muscle power, things like that. And then at the same time, we're also trying to develop technical skill to be as efficient as possible. So in a perfect world, you can be able to generate a ton of forces, but also be really efficient that you can move a lot more load than your competitor for the same amount of force. You know what I mean? So it's going to, you know, it's this game of technical and force. And if you are only monitoring the weightlifting movements or the powerlifting movements, it becomes difficult to separate those two. So if your only way to monitor if an athlete is getting stronger is by the weight that they can snatch or clean and jerk, it becomes difficult to determine, are they lifting more in the snatch and clean and jerk, which are highly technical movements, because they're able to produce more force, or because there was some sort of technical improvement, or both. And by separating your monitoring into these different categories, you can start to answer those questions. So within this kinetic area, some ways to monitor it, the most obvious, but not always practical, is going to be force plates, right? We're talking about assessing forces. If you have a device and technology that can assess force, you know, that's going to be kind of like the most obvious starting point. And then there's a host of different movements that can be done on force plate technology. Isometric movements are very popular. So a movement that you are applying force into the force plate, but you can't move, things like the isometric mid-thigh pull, where you're in the power position and you're pulling on a bar that doesn't move as hard as you can, has been used a lot in weightlifting populations. What is most common that most collegiate pro teams are doing very regularly is jump assessments. So a vertical jump, either counter movement jump or static jump on force plates. And the reason this is so popular is it's a very general movement that most people are familiar with. You know, most people have some idea of how to do a vertical jump. No, it doesn't always look great if they don't normally do it, but most people kind of, they understand that movement. So it's pretty general. And why that generality is really important is because it goes back to us trying to separate force qualities and skill or technical abilities. And if we start to do the assessment with something that requires a lot of skill and familiarity, again, that gets masked. So like if we were trying to be really specific and monitored forces during the snatch movement, we're going to start to mask the differences in technical and kinetic abilities, because somebody with better technique in the snatch movement is going to be more efficient at producing forces in important positions. But it's not necessarily because they have a greater capacity to produce force, which is something we're trying to understand when we use these like very general movements. So this is why something like a counter movement jump can be used very widely in all sorts of different populations. If we are trying to, you know, get to a more practical means of doing it, and you know, force plates isn't realistic, jump testing is also great because there's a lot of alternative solutions to force plates. So jump mats have been common. They're around for a long time. Very simple, just kind of like mat on the floor, and it just kind of measures how long the athlete spends off of the mat. And based on that time in the air, you can kind of back calculate things like jump height. And if you start to consider what the athlete weighs as well, you can start to also estimate or calculate things like power output, which is what you can get directly from a force plate. And you can estimate it from things like a jump mat. There's also a lot of video-based technologies. My Jump Lab is one I'll give a shout out to because I really like it. I think it's great. It's pretty affordable. You put it on your phone, you set it up, you record yourself or your athlete doing a vertical jump, and it immediately provides you with a lot of the same and a lot of the most valuable jump metrics that you can get from a really expensive force plate. You can get from this app on your phone, and you know, it's been validated. It's pretty good. So it's something I'd highly recommend to people before you go into looking into trying to invest into a force plate technology. Vertical jump testing with an app like that, I think is a really good way. And if you want to be real simplistic about the things you would want to look at, one of the main things you're going to get is jump height. And some people might ask, like, why is that relevant to a weightlifter? You know, they don't jump, they don't, you know, leave the floor. And while that is true, well, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier of the vertical jump being just like a really great example of physics. If we don't think of it as a jump or jump height, and we just think about it from a physics point of view, you weigh this much, and if you produce this much force, you go this high. If you weigh the same, and now you're jumping higher, it means you're probably producing more force, especially if the time that you're spending on the ground hasn't changed. Or, and this is important for weightlifters, if you weigh more and jump the same height, that's also a positive adaptation, you know, because if you are a heavier mass and you can displace your mass, your own mass, the same height, you know, you're producing greater overall absolute forces. And if you're a weightlifter and you're still within your same weight class, but you're able to produce greater overall absolute forces, you know, that's a very positive adaptation. So just with that, if you have a scale and you have some way to measure jump height, you have a really good way of monitoring changes in your kinetic abilities or your athlete's kinetic abilities over time. So that's something I would really recommend if you're just looking for kind of like a relatively bare bones, practical, affordable, valid and reliable means of assessing kinetic abilities. That's kind of what I would recommend. Yeah. So that wraps up like the kinetic category on the kinematic side of things. So now we're kind of moving away from just assessing force production capabilities. And now we're getting to kind of like the movement qualities. So position of the body, the position of the bar, the velocity and acceleration of all those different parts are obviously very highly relevant to both sports, but most especially weightlifting. There's a variety of different ways that this can be monitored. The most popular, if we're just talking firstly about like velocity and velocity specifically of the bar, are going to be velocity-based tracking technologies. So this can be sensors placed on the bar or tether type technologies that the device sits on the floor and then the tether is attached to the end of the bar. And then there's also a lot of video-based technologies. So again, you can set up an iPhone and it can kind of detect the end of the bar and follow it and assess things like velocity during the movements. I'd say this can be very valuable for the powerlifting movements. For the weightlifting movements specifically, they require a bit more interpretation because a greater bar velocity isn't necessarily always, you know, a good thing. Because if it was just about moving a bar as fast as possible, you can get in some like really funky, weird positions to just accelerate the bar as fast as you could. But it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get under it in a solid position with your elbows locked and be able to stabilize it and stand it up and get three white lights on the platform. You know, that requires you to hit very specific position. So it's not quite as easy as faster is better. Now with the powerlifting movements, they're a bit more simplistic, they're a bit more linear, and you know, for the most part, faster is going to be better. I think it's just important to keep in mind that a big difference when using velocity technology with strength sports versus using it in like other athletic populations is just remembering that the end goal of strength sports is to be able to move greater absolute loads, and the speed technically doesn't actually matter. You know, it's who just lifts the most at the end of the day. Whereas in a lot of other, you know, team-based sports, moving a lighter load faster is going to be a very positive adaptation for them because they're not necessarily looking to move like as heavy external forces as possible. They just move most often their own load, their own weight. And if they can, you know, move a set load faster, that's going to be a positive adaptation. Now, in a lot of cases, that's also going to be a positive adaptation in the powerlifting realm. But like I said, you just don't want to go like so all in on focusing on the velocity of the bar that you forget that the main goal of it is to be able to lift more load. But velocity monitoring, I do think, can be very valuable for the powerlifts and then also for accessory lifts for weightlifters. And one of the reasons kind of goes back to the purpose of monitoring that I explained earlier. And it's to be able to assess if what you're happening and what you expect to happening is actually happening. And if you're regularly monitoring something like velocity on the bar, that allows you to do that without always having to push the total load. So instead of being able to see if an athlete is getting stronger by just lifting more, by putting more load on the bar, you have more wiggle room where you can see if they're lifting the same load faster or a lower load, you know, slower. So when you're able to do that, you can kind of look at what's realistically happening versus what you expect to happen more often within a single set. Them. You know, if you're expecting them to be tired and fatigued in the bar to move a little bit slower, and that does happen, then that's not necessarily a problem. If you're expecting them to be very fresh and the load that they're moving to be moving very fast, you know, you can immediately have that feedback. And I'd say, I think that's probably the most valuable thing about velocity-based technologies. There's a lot of things that they can be used for, like estimating 1RMs and load velocity profiles and things like that. But I'd say far and away, they're most valuable for is just immediate feedback within a session, rep to rep, you know, being able to see the velocity you're hitting and then either in your head as a coach or athlete, referencing that to what you expect. You know, if you use it often enough, you know the velocity that you would expect to see with a certain load. And if you're way off of that, you might change things up within that session or, you know, kind of look back at what you've been doing before and ask the question, like, why are my expectations so off? Like, why am I moving so much slower than I would expect or how much I normally do? And then if you're really regularly tracking this stuff and like analyzing it, you don't necessarily have to do those things in your head. You can also analytically look at, you know, historically, we have all this data on load and velocity. Based on that, what would we expect your velocity to be based on the load you're doing? And if there is this large separation, that's you know, valuable feedback to be able to use like within your monitoring system. So you can do that as just kind of like a mental model within the session, or you can actually do that, you know, more objectively by like capturing the data regularly and, you know, developing kind of some statistical analyses around it if you have the ability to do so. Other than, you know, the velocity tracking, you know, of the barbell and different technologies, the other side of the kinematics is the, you know, actual positions, one of the athlete and of the barbell. This is something that any coach is going to be doing on a daily basis anyway. You know, they're always paying attention to the positions their athletes are in. You know, they're providing them sort of feedback and seeing if they can affect those positions based on their feedback. So that's something that, you know, is regularly being done, you know, subjectively by the coach on a daily basis. We can also objectively monitor some of these things. So again, there's a lot of video-based applications that can do this. A lot of them are going to be focused on bar tracking because it's a bit more simpler to do with simple technologies. They just need to identify the end of the barbell, and then they can assess things like bar path and bar trajectory. When it starts to get into more of like the body and joint angle specific kinematics, you know, very simple based technologies are going to become more limited here. One, because it's going to be harder for these markerless based solutions to be able to track multiple different joints, and especially as they move at like high velocities. So like the most gold standard perfect way to do this would be going in a biomechanics lab and getting a bunch of markers on you, which is absolutely not very practical or feasible at all. But you know, there are some apps that can do it. In a more feasible solution is just using video, like over time, just regularly getting videos of your athlete, especially if you maybe don't use it like in that same session that you're taking it, but you might want to refer back to it, you know, a few weeks or months or even like years later, when you're either one, it could be the athlete is struggling and you might want to go back and look at, you know, is there any sort of like kinematic changes or biomechanical changes that have happened since then that they made and maybe like went unnoticed, that if we go back to what they were doing before, it can bring them back. You know, or on the other end, they can be performing really well, and you kind of want to see, you want to start to answer like, why are they performing well? Is it because of the getting stronger? And then you can refer to, if you are monitoring kinetic stuff, you can refer to that. The kinetic stuff hasn't changed. Is it because their technique is getting better? And then you can kind of just look back on a video and kind of qualitatively, you know, assess it. So I think just regularly getting video of your athletes so that you can kind of retroactively go back and look is probably realistically the most like feasible way to be able to do some like kinematic biomechanical monitoring in a practical sense regularly with your weightlifters. So that covers the main aspects of kinematic monitoring. The next category that we put in is body composition, like anthropometrics. And one of the things we noted is within anthropometrics, there's a lot of importance in things like limb lengths and height and how those things have an effect on weightlifting and powerlifting performance. But from a monitoring perspective, when we're talking about assessing an individual over time, they're not that important, because unless you're working with youth athletes, they don't necessarily change. You know, we're not going to have drastic changes in arm length or leg length or things like that. So realistically, monitoring them regularly isn't going to be as important. What is important is the body composition piece. So we go back to what we talked about earlier at a like very simplistic all else equal level. When we're talking about moving greater absolute loads, which is the goal of strength sports, you know, more force is going to be better. What produces force? Well, muscle, you know, contractile tissue produces force. And then also within weightlifting, powerlifting, this is highly relevant because we have weight classes, right? So in an ideal world, you have as much muscle as you can fit within a weight class. Now, this is going to be kind of like individual, because most of us can't walk around at 0% body fat, or although some people look like they do, most people can't. So there's going to be a certain level of body fat that an individual is going to need to have to be able to, you know, recover from training regularly. But also at the same time, we're trying to optimize them within their weight class so that they have the greatest competitive advantage against, you know, against other athletes within their weight class. And then we can also use it to determine if an athlete is in the right weight class. You know what I mean? If you've worked with a lot of athletes of different sizes and shapes, and you've gathered things like height and weight and circumference measures and things like that, you're going to have a somewhat good idea of like your outliers that it probably could benefit from either like going up a weight class or going down the weight class, because it's just not a great fit for them.
Would you have any examples how you would go about assessing anthropometrics and fitting the athlete to the weight class?
Yeah. So at the very most basic level, something that everybody can do and start with is just a scale to be able to regularly monitor body weight. Again, it's a their weight class sports. Like your body weight is important. One, just to make sure you're within a range to be able to make your weight class. And then two, body weight in itself can be a kind of valuable metric to assess in athletes in general, just to assess kind of the training state and adaptation. Something that you could tend to see in athletes that are highly fatigued or struggling to recover, you often see body weight start to drop and that you otherwise like can't explain. And when you can tie that into other measures, if you are measuring kinetic values and force outputs, and then you're also seeing changes in the subjective measures that you're assessing or just getting from your athletes. And then you also see, you know, downward fluctuation of the body weight. When you started to put all those things together, you know, it could kind of tell you a lot about the training state of an athlete. So one, it's important to monitor because, you know, it's a weight class sport. Two, it's important to monitor because it can kind of give you that additional piece to determining, you know, the state that your athlete's in. And three, it's just simple. Like it's cheap and easy to get a scale and stand on it regularly. So like that's always going to be like the first place to start. After that, there's a lot of technologies available to do some body composition analysis. InBodies have gotten really popular. It's a BIA technology where you just stand on it and grab the handles and you can get some body composition. They are really easy and feasible, and a lot of like commercial gyms even have them now. So like they're somewhat easily accessible. I would just put a huge caveat on them that any of those sorts of like BIA technologies, and then especially the ones that are like built into some scales that you can buy, can be really unreliable. And there's a lot of things that can cause them to fluctuate a lot. Most of that has to do with the things that you put in your body beforehand, what you've eaten before, how much you drank, or if you've exercised. I will say from experience using them in different populations, if you're super consistent about when you use it and the things you do before it, they're actually pretty good. So it can be a pretty good practical option. You just want to consider stand on them at a similar time of day. So if you're going to do it, go in the morning every time or in the afternoon time, and then standardize what you're doing before. So maybe go on it fasted so that you don't have to worry about what you eat affecting it. Consider hydration level. If you regularly do it and stand on it and you're hydrated, and then one day you stand on it and you're dehydrated, it's going to completely affect your values. So if you can be very consistent and standard with it and you can find one that's available to you, it can be a pretty good technology to be able to assess things like body fat percentage and skeletal muscle mass. If you can afford it, you know, what would be more considered more of a gold standard would be doing like a full DEXA, which would be kind of nice because you could get things like bone density stuff as well. There are a lot of third-party companies that you can Google and find that offer DEXAs, but we're talking about a much higher price point now. If, you know, price point is a concern or you're just looking for something that you can do at home a lot more regularly, as far as on like the muscle mass side of things, you can just do like circumference measures, like just take measuring tape and, you know, measuring things like your quads or stuff like that. The main consideration there is you have to consider that if your quads get bigger, you have to consider whether they're getting bigger just because of muscle mass gain, or is it also body fat gain or body fat loss? Whereas these other body composition measures to kind of separate that, just, you know, a circumference measure isn't going to. So you have to be a little bit more creative with that process. Skin folds for the body fat is an option that's a lot cheaper. Like you can just go online and buy a skin fold caliper and look up how to do it. The concerns there is if you aren't trained in it and don't have the skill set around it, you know, they can be pretty unreliable. And then some of the estimation equations can be a bit inaccurate. If you are, again, really consistent with it and you have this, if you're the coach and you do it on an athlete and you're the same only person that always does it, or somebody does it on you and it's the same person that always does it on you and you don't change that, then they can offer some benefit. One way you can get around some of their inaccuracies is instead of like punching in the skin fold numbers and estimating body fat, is you can just monitor the skin folds themselves so that you don't introduce any like new error. So if your skin fold is 10 millimeters and now it's 12 millimeters, if you think that that's a reasonable amount of change from what you've seen historically, you can kind of start to assume that maybe you gained some body fat. Or on the other hand, if you start to see all your skin folds going down, you can assume. So that's kind of a bit of a more practical way to go out doing it. And then if you also want to kind of like validate these things a little bit more, is you can do, you know, a variety of them. Maybe you do something like circumference and skin folds very regularly, you know, weekly, monthly, or something like that. And then occasionally you try to find access to an InBody, maybe find bi-monthly or quarterly or something like that. And then maybe like once a year you do a DEXA. So then you kind of like spread it out. But when you start to put all those things together, you kind of feel a bit better about the trend. Like if they're all going in the same direction, then you feel a bit more confident that's a true change versus if you just pay attention to any one of these single body composition measures. All body composition measures can be a bit sketchy. So it's definitely something to consider. Not freak out about like any single one individual change. But if you can get enough consistent monitoring over time, the trends will kind of start, you know, to reveal themselves.
I think that's exactly what great coaches do. They have a plan and they know the athlete really well. So they're expecting things to go a certain way, positively or negatively, in terms of mood and how they behave and so on, and then they come to the session and observe and see what's going on and then modify the program or not depending on what is ahead, what is the goal. So do you think that younger coaches or less experienced coaches can speed up this development of coaching art by using technology or monitoring to be able to notice the patterns faster or learn them faster?
Yes, and I love that you asked this question because I think about this a lot, and I'll take this somewhat outside of the strength sports realm just for a little bit because it's a really good example. Coming from the baseball world, I've seen a lot of examples of this because in the baseball world, technology and data is a very, very, very big deal, and it's had very rapid growth in the last 10 to 20 years. And baseball is also a very historical sport. You know, it's America's pastime. So there's been a lot of people that have been involved in it for a very long time. So when you work with coaches in the baseball world, you have this very large spectrum of like really, really old school coaches that aren't really familiar with the technology or the data and things like that, but they've been doing it for so long and they can kind of just see things and you know, make changes. And then you have these like really young, innovative coaches that are all in on the technology and all in on the data. And there's definitely pros and cons to like both those aspects. But one observation I have had that you kind of like referenced a bit is one thing that I've found is some of these like younger coaches that really like adopt the technology and data, I think their rate of development as a coach has been faster than the coaches that didn't necessarily have access to that. Because now, you know, the coach that's been doing it for years and decades, they've just over time been kind of like calibrating these different thoughts in their head. They see something happen with a pitcher or a hitter and they make some sort of suggestion or change. And then they see if that had a positive or negative effect on them, you know, and they take that in and then they think about it again and they might try it on another athlete. And just over like years and years and years, they get better at that. These younger coaches do that, but also have the advantage of getting like immediate, real, analytical, objective feedback. And in the pro baseball realm, it's on every single, in the case of a pitcher, it's on every single pitch that they throw. You know, so we're talking about like really, really, really high quantity of data. So they're able to kind of train those models in their head about what's happening much faster and probably more accurately because of the use of technology. And then to not like bias that the younger coaches are better than older coaches, the best coaches I've observed in my experience are kind of like in the middle where they're not like only focused on staring at the iPad during like a pitching session, but they're also have used the technology to like make them a better coach because they've kind of had that like faster advancement in the like rate of development because they regularly are thinking about and setting their expectations of what's going to happen and then referring it to technology to see what actually happened and then like recalibrating that and then learning from it and then going back. That's happening every single pitch for every single athlete that they work with. So kind of example outside of strength sport, but yeah, I do 100% agree that coaches that do start to adopt these like technologies and like a data-based approach can increase the rate of development as a coach faster than if they didn't have access to these technologies. What separates like the science just from like data to me is that, like you were kind of saying, the experimental piece, and good coaches have been experimenting in their heads for a very long time. And you know, experimenting is a big part of science. Now, you can collect data, and if you never think about, you know, we use the term expectations a lot. You know, if you haven't been coaching very long, haven't coached a lot of athletes, like you don't even know what to expect. So if you're just tracking like what's happening in the data, you know, you can go in a lot of different places because if you've been coaching long enough, your expectations are going to be a bit more calibrated. You know, there are certain things that you might do in training that in the short term are going to have some sort of negative effect on your athlete. But long-term can have a positive effect. And if you didn't know that and didn't have those expectations and only looked at data and you saw things tracking down, you'd say, oh, that's bad. Don't do that. Try something else. You know what I mean? That's not necessarily a scientific approach, and you know, there's not experimentation there. And that also removes like that like art of coaching piece. So yeah, that piece of having the proper expectations and then looking at that and how that it compares to the objective piece and the data and the technology that you're using, that's really like, that's where the main advantage of this stuff comes from, rather than just within the technology or the numbers themselves. It's that model for being able to put those things together that I think makes for the best coaches.
What do we look for in the data? So I'm looking for some frameworks. Okay, we decided, a coach decided they want to collect some data. They decided they will start with this and that. Now they have a bunch of data. Would you have any frameworks to offer how to make use of these?
Yeah, so the kind of two frameworks I would suggest. One is one that we've talked a lot about it, this kind of like framework of expected versus like actual. So, you know, you can do that just like mentally or visually or something like that, or you can do it actually analytically. Like when you're having certain trends in the data, you can have, you know, a trend of what you expect. That could be you just inputting what you expect, or it could be you developing some sort of like statistical model to predict what would happen. And then we're looking at that, you know, trend compared to what's actually happening. So I always refer to that expected versus actual framework. The other framework that's really important with monitoring is establishing normal fluctuations and non-normal fluctuations, because everything is going to have a certain amount of fluctuation and noise to it. Even, you know, body weight. If anybody regularly weighs themselves, like you almost never weigh exactly what you did yesterday. And it's not necessarily because of technological error. I mean, like you could get a really good scale and you can calibrate it. You can put a known weight on it and it could be spot on. But every time you step on it, even throughout a single day, is going to be a little bit different because there's just so many things that like influence it. And that's true of something very, very simple like body weight. Now we get into more like complex things like bar velocity and body fat percentage from a BIA. There's going to be a lot more like technological noise and then also biological noise. Like there's just going to be natural variations within like individual humans. So that like noise and that fluctuation, it's important to start to understand like what's normal so that you're not always reacting to normal fluctuations. You know, every time you react to a certain value going down, then like you're never actually going to be able to do science or experiment because you're constantly going to be changing the plan. Like if you don't have an initial like plan, like an initial hypothesis to test, like you can't really experiment because you're changing something every single time. So one way to do this like visually is, you know, establishing if you're visually showing like a trend line, you can put some sort of like shaded range around it. There's a lot of like ways you can do this like analytically, like establishing what sort of range that is. But also if you've been looking at the data long enough, you'll start to get like a good idea of what's normal. It's like if you look at like your own body weight for long enough, you'll start to understand like, all right, you know, a half kilo fluctuation, I'm not thinking too much about. 1 kilo fluctuation, I'm like, oh, that's weird. What did I do yesterday that changed that? You know, more than that, I'm like, all right, that's real strange. You can do that with all of these other values once you've seen it enough. You start to establish like, okay, I'm okay with this much change, but this much change, I'm going to start looking deeper into it. So, you know, if you don't have the capabilities to do a more like analytical approach, you can just say like, this is my value that I'm following. If it changes by this much up or down, I'm going to pay attention to it and like dig a little further. So if you're tracking that in your athletes and this value you're tracking has changed past that range, that might be your trigger to reach out to them like, hey, how are you feeling today? How's training going? Or something like that. So that you're not doing that every single time it goes up or down, you know, a couple percentage points, because then it's not going to become very valuable if you're just reaching out to them every single day. Like, hey, I saw, you know, your jump height was down by a half a centimeter. How are you feeling? Like, I'm fine. What are you talking about? So I think that framework, you know, establishing what is and isn't a normal change, and when you go outside of what's normal, using that as a trigger to dig further is a good framework. And then some, you know, model of looking at what's actually happening versus what you're expecting happening.
All right. Would you have any advice on implementation? So how to go about implementing an athlete monitoring program or measures?
Yeah, so I think it's important to start with questioning what you're trying to get before you start picking, you know, technology or measures. I think a lot of people like start in the other order, like they see a cool technology and then they buy it and they start tracking stuff. And then they never kind of have like a lot of, you know, a lot of what we've talked today is like these frameworks and these mental models for like using this stuff, but they like skip over that stuff because they just jump to like the technology and the metric. And they're like, all right, yeah, I'm tracking bar velocity now. All right, why? You know, what are you doing with it? Like what happens when it changes? You know what I mean? So I think starting with asking the questions of what do you think is going to be important for you to monitor? And not only is it important to monitor, but if it changes, would that trigger you to do something differently? Because if it doesn't, then it might not be that valuable to monitor. Like maybe, yeah, it might be cool to know like what your value is on this certain sort of test. But if it's not going to actually like influence like your training program or your coaching at all, there's probably other things that are more valuable. So I think, you know, starting with asking, you know, the important questions of why do you want to monitor this? What are you going to do about it is the best place to start with implementation. And then from there, you can start to consider like, all right, I know I want to monitor this. What are my best options within my environment? You know, then you can start to look at like, all right, if you can, money's not a question and not a problem, then yeah, you can jump straight to like the most expensive gold standard approach. Realistically, most times that's not the best way to go about doing it. So you can start to try and find those like middle ground things like that are a bit more practical and feasible, but also relatively like valid and accurate. So I think starting with that approach before like jumping in and just starting to track stuff, I think would be a good approach, because I think a lot of people end up starting to track a bunch of stuff and then don't ever do anything with it and don't know what to do with it and don't have the skill set to do with it. And then they just drop everything. So instead of like having a smaller, more feasible monitoring program, they try to have this like big comprehensive monitoring program and then it doesn't work. So then they have go back to no monitoring program again. So, you know, start small, start with things that are important to you that you can manage and things that are actually going to like influence what you're doing on a daily basis, I think would be the most important things to consider when trying to implement this stuff.
Would you have some take home messages for coaches, maybe 1, 2, 3 or, you know, 2 points that coaches should take or you would like them to really remember from this conversation and apply in the coaching practice?
Yeah, I think the main thing to consider is that, you know, establishing some sort of like monitoring program with athletes you work with doesn't have to be like as scary and as difficult as it might seem for somebody that hasn't done it before. You know, it can start very simplistic. I would suggest and push people more towards actually finding methods of doing it where they can actually be collecting the data over time instead of just, you know, just doing it like verbally or just putting it like in a training log that lives somewhere. Because the one thing we kind of haven't talked about that's like all over everywhere right now is like advancing AI and technologies like that. And I do think those technologies are going to be interesting. They already are allowing people that don't necessarily have like analytical or technical backgrounds to do pretty cool things with data, but you need that data in the first place. So like, even if you've been collecting really simple data, like just some subjective stuff, and you had your athletes punch in their body weight and some subjective ratings, and then you connected that to the loads that they had been doing, there's some pretty cool analyses that you can do after you've had a good amount of historical information with that. And now we're getting to the point that you can just take that stuff and be like, hey, ChatGPT, analyze this and answer this question for me. And that's only going to continue to advance more and more and more. So I would, you know, try and push and suggest people could start trying to actually collect some concrete like amount of data somewhere, even if they're not immediately like looking for ways to like analyze it. But on the same end, also just, you know, trying to get across to like, it doesn't have to be this very like complex, crazy, like analytical thing. Like it could be relatively simple. And for most part, usually the simpler, the more effective, as long as it's kind of like been well thought out.
All right. So 2 short questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
My favorite lift. Well, this has changed a lot. Let's see. Right now, it's going to be something really bro-y. Right now, I really have been enjoying dumbbell bench press, though. It's been a few years since I've done a snatch and clean and jerk. Back when I was actively weightlifting, it was definitely the clean. And I'm going to leave the jerk out of it because the jerk is hard and difficult and mean. But love some heavy cleans. But yeah.
Sounds good. And if people want to follow your work, get in touch or see what you're up to, where they should go online.
Yeah, my both Twitter and Instagram are under the handle Suarez Strength, my last name and Strength. On LinkedIn, Dylan Suarez.
Awesome, Dylan. I'll be looking forward to that. Thank you very much for today. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you having me on.